Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
So, Jordan, you know, we're going to have a very interesting guest, a guy that, like, drives a car, right? And he drives them, like, real fast. But I don't know if you remember the time I called you.
This is why I do the intros.
Go I wonder if you remember the time when I called you, you know, when I was in my super fast Tesla. And I ran out of electricity in my car. So why is it you didn't come and help me now that I was stuck there? Is that – I mean, what – That I've been thinking about that, and I'm just wondering if it's a breakdown in our relationship. You know, I don't know.
It's more so science. I know you're from the Republican Party. You don't necessarily embrace the idea of science, but there's a distance between New York City and flyover country where you're located, and I believe that's a good 10-hour drive. And as much as I wanted to help you when your time of need, when your car had run out of energy, it wasn't feasible for somebody to get there in the right amount of time.
Well, let me ask you this. Why didn't you say, if you stay put, I'll be there? I mean, we didn't put any time limit on it. Mm-hmm. I could have sat there and, you know, and just had deep thoughts waiting for you to arrive, but you never said, I'll get on a plane. I mean, that doesn't take 10 hours, but okay. I mean, it's now, do you have an electric car? Would you think about buying one? What's your thoughts about that?
Well, I will say that, first of all, let's break this down to two parts. One, I think it's a vote of confidence. If you need somebody to get on a plane and help you plug in your car, you need more than help from a person in New York. Things are in a bad place. And I think I respect you enough to say, you know what, the governor is going to figure this out in the next 10 hours. I don't think I can beat him to the punch.
You know, Jordan, if you and your wife needed to get away and the babysitter was going to cancel, and you called me and said, you know, you've had two kids, you've grown them up, they're smart, they're beautiful, they're everything, they're nice, would you come? I would say, yeah, I'll come over. I'll even drive my electric car if I need to.
You'd come and babysit?
Why not? You wouldn't trust me?
Whit would get the best night's sleep. I would just say, Governor, can you just tell him about the good old days? And he would be out for hours. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, but you missed the point. I would show up.
Okay. You would drive out. I mean, I appreciate that.
I would
that.
Get on a plane and come and babysit Whit if you needed it. If you really needed it, I'd do it. Why not?
That's a gross misuse of resources. At this point, financially,
not to spend great time with Whit. That would be a lot of fun. He could learn a lot from me, too.
You're spending too much money. It's not worth it time-wise. I should invest that money into a local babysitter, have that person come over, take care of Whit.
What do you pay a babysitter, by the way, Jordan? Do you...
Oh. I'll take. What do you think? What do you think a babysitter goes for nowadays?
I'm not in the circus business. I don't guess. So you tell me what you pay.
Give me a guess. This is what people listen for.
All right.
Governor.
Let me say. What do you think? Let me just say $17 an hour.
Okay. $25 an hour, and then also if the babysitter is coming over late, you're paying for their ride or Uber home. And
yeah.
So I will say I was invited to, my wife and I were invited to go see a film recently, and it was a film we'd already seen. It was like a replay of a Japanese film that a friend of ours was like, do you guys want to go see this? They're replaying this. It's fun to see it in the theater. And when I ran the numbers, I was like, well, getting there, it's a long movie. It's a 3-hour film. It would be about 4 hours of babysitting. and at night I would pay for, I was like, it would cost us $150 $50 to walk out the door to see a movie we've already seen.
And that brings up another interesting thing here, and that is when you went to see the Nets play, mm-hmm. okay?
Yes.
What did those tickets cost? What did the babysitter cost? Was that like a couple grand to get that done?
We're not quite grand area, but we are. Okay. I mean,
well, you're rich though. You've told me that you have a lot of money.
I'm mega rich. So yes. these are numbers I'm just making up because they mean nothing to me. But yeah, I'm walking out the door and I'm spending $150 with the babysitter, and then for tickets, you're in the $100 to $150 range. So that's already a bunch of money. You throw any kind of drinks on it, and you know, if I'm going out, I'm gonna get lit. I'm a party guy. I like my whiskey. So I'm gonna shell out for a cocktail at Barclays Center, and dear Lord, do you know what?
Here's another thing. I'd say that's about $17, right?
Do you want to know how much a whiskey cocktail is at the Barclays Center?
How much?
I think it's $30 to $35.
Are you kidding me?
It's insane.
$35.
It is insane.
Sneak the stuff in.
I know. This is what the metal detectors are for. They think it's for weaponry and it's for flasks.
It's to detect liquor.
This is honestly, it's an insane number, to the point that I had gone to an event weeks before and I had paid for a drink and I was like, I knew it was going to be high and I'm shocked by it. And so I prepared myself the next time I went to like a concert and I was still, I'm like, my jaw drops. I'm like, and I like two drinks. One drink is not enough. So at that point I'm shelling out and I like to tip. I'm a nice guy. I'm in the $60-$70 range for a couple of drinks. It's tough.
You know, you wonder, what I've always wondered about is that people that go to these sporting events and they pay, you know, I know that the Formula One race in Miami, which we can talk to Bobby about, people were paying, I am not kidding you, for the weekend, like $25,000 to go to this Formula One deal. I know they never paid that to see Bobby race, you know, I know, but I mean, can you imagine?
You'll let him defend himself.
Yeah, we'll let them. But what do you, I mean, isn't that unbelievable? Who are these people? Do they write it off? Do they come? I mean, I just don't understand it.
There's probably that second tier of it, right? My brother works in the sports industry and works for teams in Detroit. And I know there's a lot of it has to do with those boxes. I think if you can write it off as a company.
Yeah, but does anybody go to see any sports in Detroit? I mean, since the Bad Boys.
Wow.
Since the Bad Boys, you know, I mean, and since Kirk Gibson came out of the dugout and I mean, that was great. That was great. But anyway,
Gibson did that for the Dodgers, sadly. He wasn't even doing that for the Tigers. No, they see the Red Wings play. They have affinity for the Tigers.
No, it's great. Look, it's great. I'm going to tell you one more thing. So this is a little sports thing. But my daughter moved to Boston. One of them moved to Boston. And so she's got this now new affinity for the Red Sox. And of course, mm-hmm. Dad's got some interest now in the Red Sox. So I was watching the game the other night. Got to the ninth inning. It was tied. Yankees come up in the 10th. Judge hits, I don't know. I just was not even paying attention because I figured the Yankees would win. And the Yankees score a couple runs. And I think, oh, this game's over. I go to sleep. I wake up the next day and I look at this highlight. And this guy drives in three runs. And they guy slides into home plate and they beat the damn Yankees. It was exciting. Baseball's in those minutes, right? Baseball is really, it's got it. It's different than about any other sport, but I know it can drag and drag and drag. But boy, it was cool to see.
Governor, I got to tell you, you are stretching my patience. You come on here, a Republican, okay, an Ohio State fan, and now you're a Red Sox fan. Like who am I, Joan of Arc?
No, I'm actually not. I'm actually a Guardians fan, you know, because of people like you, we had to change the name. And I'm
people
also
like me.
Also a Pirates fan. It's hard to root. You can't root for the Pirates because they can't win. You know, the owner doesn't make any effort to win. It's just crazy.
Do you have
like
any
Michigan
issue with
all those years?
Oh, please. Do you have issues with Guardians? See, it's easy. Become the Guardians. That's what progress is. It was a bad name anyway.
That's what I thought. It was just you kind of people that. But the Kansas City
kind of
Chiefs.
People.
But hey, Kansas City Chiefs. That's okay, right?
No. No.
Oh, no. We're going to get rid of that, too?
Yeah. Why have these names? If they are offensive, they're archaic.
So you're against that? Are you going to campaign against change the name for the Kansas City Chiefs? We could change them to the Kansas City, Mound Builders or whatever.
Sure. I mean, these names are dumb. Let's be honest. The Bears, the Tigers, these are better names. These are not better names. And I do think the ones that are attached to a culture or to people in a way that minimizes it, of course, change it. It's so easy to change it. What's the big deal? Guess what? You know what they're doing anyway? They're just trying to sell you jerseys anyway. They're changing colors. They're doing throwback stylings. Like, people aren't going to buy new jerseys anyway in Kansas City, in Cleveland.
Yeah, you know what? They do change. It all. It's like shoes. You know, you get a pair of running shoes, you love them. You go in like 2 weeks later and they go, oh, no, we don't sell those anymore. Right. So you got to get a whole, I mean, it's, you know, anyway, we're going on and on and on and on. Why don't you introduce our guest?
That's it in a nutshell. I thought you were going to say, like, it's like running shoes. They keep improving so you can get new ones. But instead, you're lamenting the fact that the shoes you liked 2 weeks ago have changed to something new.
Exactly right. Now, people have either turned this off or they've just got out of their car and said, I've had enough of these two guys.
They aren't even listening. If you get out of your car, give the governor a call. No matter how far away, he will come to save you. That's what he does. Okay, we have an excited guest right now. Our guest this week is a legendary auto racing driver. He's a team owner. He's a proud, sad to say it, Ohioan, three-time Indy car champion and Indy 500 winner, currently the founder and owner of the Bobby Rahal Automotive Group and co-owner of Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing. It's Bobby Rahal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really sorry to interrupt you guys because I was actually enjoying that. So if you want me just to sit in the background, you guys can keep going. But
no, but, Bobby, get in the driver's seat. This we watch you. How fast could you make that drive from New York back to Ohio? You could pull. Ooh. You know what could you do that in?
Well, I think if you really tried, you could probably make it in, say, Manhattan to Columbus, Ohio. You probably could make that in about 8 to 9 hours, I'd bet.
Okay. See,
yeah, do so you, that's my,
come on, Bobby, you drove faster than that. What the hell are you talking about?
Well, no, I mean, heck, just getting across Pennsylvania is about 5.5.
Good point. Know? That's good point. Well, that's because of all the toll roads and everything.
Maybe 6 hours.
No matter how fast you drive through Pennsylvania, it's never fast enough.
No, I like Pennsylvania, so.
Okay, sorry, Bobby.
Yeah, he's selling cars over there. Come on, Jordan, know your audience.
Do you, Bobby, if you take a cross-country trip, leisurely, as not as a professional, but as yourself, do you feel a pressure to push it, to exceed, to bend the rules? Because no? Do you find, is it comforting?
First off, I don't have to because everybody else is. So I can just kind of go along for the ride. And I don't know if you've ever gone up from, say, Indianapolis to Chicago on I-65. That's kind of like the Indy 500 going up. I mean, mm-hmm. people in Detroit, they're 20 over the limit and minimum. So I don't feel any pressure. The pressure for me is to keep up with everybody.
That was always, I remember learning how to drive and going through my student driving course in Michigan, and you get on the highway, and it is, folks are going 20 over, and if you're going 50, they're honking at you, and you're like, it's such a lesson, and like, I know what the rules are, but there's the rules of the road, you have to adopt those as well,
they don't call it the Motown for nothing,
How do you guys know each other? I want to put this together. As Ohioans, do you all know each other?
Me and the governor? Well, I moved to Columbus in 1981, end of 81, to drive for a fellow named Jim Truman, who started the Red Roof Inn hotel chain. And, of course, John was already, governor was already a fixture, a very public persona. In Ohio, we met. I certainly think hit it off. Just a good person. And I was just telling my wife earlier today when she said, "So who are you on this show with?" And I said, "Well, it's Governor Kasich." When I won Indy in 1986, I had the honor and pleasure, privilege to meet President Reagan. And Governor Kasich was the one who arranged that meeting. We had lunch at the congressional restaurant there prior to meeting President Reagan. In fact, I still have the checkered flag that flew over the Capitol that Governor Kasich gave me, and met a lot of interesting people. I remember Trent Lott. I met him during lunch, And in any event, then, of course, getting to meet President Reagan, which was really something. So that's really when the relationship began. And then, of course, all the years I lived in Columbus, you know, we played golf together, you know, just, you know.
Bobby, you remember, the story is when we got into the Oval Office to meet Reagan, mm-hmm. Jordan, Reagan looks over at Bobby and he says to Bobby, because Bobby's just won the 500, which we got to hear what it's like to do that. And he says to Bobby, have you ever heard of Barney Oldfield?
Yeah.
And Bobby says, oh, yeah, he was one of the greatest Indy drivers ever in the history of the sport. And Reagan said, well, one time I was in California, I was driving on the freeway, got this new car, I was stepping on it, and a California patrolman pulls me over. And he walks over to my window, I put the window down, and the policeman looks at me and says, who do you think you are, Barney Oldfield? And yeah. Reagan looks at the cop and says, no, but if you'd like to meet him, he's sitting right next to me.
That's right. That's
he was
right.
in the car
That's
with right. him. But yeah. you might remember that. So when is what in that 500, Bobby? Just tell us what the day was like. Tell us the discipline that goes into it, the excitement, because there's people listening who they don't know much about mm-hmm. race cars, mm-hmm. right? Or tell us a little bit about it. Get people's interest perked up a little bit here.
Indianapolis, the 500 is, I really think, I'm not sure of other sporting events that if a person wins that, it changes their life professionally and personally, you know, forever. But the Indianapolis 500 definitely does that for a driver. So when you go into that month of May, you know, the importance of the race and the history of the race. You know, it's been around for over 100 years, by far the longest race in this country. You know, you just know fortune shines upon you and you win this race that things are different from there on out. And, what made the year I won, I guess different is that a couple things really. Number one, it rained out the entire weekend when the race was supposed to have been held, and which was, I think, May 25th was the original date, which also happened to be the birth date of my team owner, Jim Truman, who I just mentioned a little earlier. Unfortunately for Jim, he was in very poor health because of colon cancer. And so here's a race was going to be on his 51st birthday, and it was canceled till the next weekend. And so we go to the next weekend, and many people still attended the race, even though a lot had bought tickets for the previous weekend and had to go back home wherever.
How many would be there, Bobby? How many would be in attendance?
What's probably typical? For the race I won, there was probably about 300,000 people. I mean, Indianapolis is the largest single day sporting event in the world. And, I mean, for example, the Daytona 500 might attract 150,000 people or somewhere around there. Indies, I think this year we had about 370,000, 350,000, something like that. It really is an amazing place. And so in any event, for us and for me, for the team, here we are a week later, our owner, who really is the guy who gave us our chances and our opportunities, was literally on death's door. You know, I think we all felt within the team that if we were going to win one, we better do this. And sure enough, we had a great race, raced with Rick Mears for most of the race. Then a young fellow named Kevin Cogan got in the mix, won the race with two laps to go on a restart, set the fastest lap of the race on the last lap, and then and won. And of course, that was a big deal for me, obviously, big deal for our team, big deal for Jim Truman, who tragically died about 10 days later. I remember going through, there was a parade downtown Columbus for us. So it was a big deal, a very meaningful deal, kind of a bittersweet program, a little bittersweet deal for us because of Jim's health. But as I've always told people, I said, how many people are able to realize a dream for someone else? And our team did that for Jim on that day.
I'm curious, as you're racing around, having to be a driver, and we'll get into sort of what it means and what it takes to be a top tier driver. But I'm sure focus is right up there, because a lack of focus mm-hmm. can be
right.
deadly. But also having this momentous occasion, a lap or two away, Does it start to creep in? How do you mentally keep out the possibility of winning the Indy 500 as you're approaching winning the Indy 500? Or is that something that, like, at what point do you become aware that it's going to happen? When you get giddy and started screaming like a little girl inside the car?
You know, I had led the race in previous years. 86 was our fifth year there. I had led in 83, led in 87, 85. So I didn't win it in any of those years, but had led. But when the race starts, I mean, you're really focused on just driving, you know, what you're doing. Because, I mean, you don't have the luxury of thinking about something that might happen an hour later. You know, it's all about right here and now. And, you know, I mean, we led a lot of the race. I think I led somewhere around 60 to 70 laps. So, you know, a third of the race at least, and or thereabouts. And Rick led about the same number of laps, I think. You know, when you're racing, you're so focused on what's going on around you and in front of you that you don't really think about.
And how fast are you going, Jordan?
You shouldn't be thinking about anything else. It's all about competition.
How fast are you going at that point?
My last lap, the average speed was 209 miles an hour. So that meant you're probably doing 225 or 30 down the straights, you know, which at that time was fast. Today, they're qualifying at 235 miles an hour, which means you're 245 miles an hour going down the straights. I mean, it's a, you know, they're even faster today. But no, I think, you know, when that last opportunity came up on the restart with two laps to go, it's, you know, it's now or never. And now's your shot. And, you know, are you going to take it? Or are you going to be one of these people that sits there and regrets, you know, not being prepared? And we were prepared and we ended up winning the race.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Now, in 1987, you were going to win that race. Tell Jordan a little bit about our listeners. Tell them about what happened in 1987, because people expected you were going to win that race.
Well, actually, 1987, we were qualified in the middle of the front row. It was Mario Andretti, me, and Rick Mears. That was the front row. But we had an engine issue initially in 87, led the race for a bit. But really, 1990, I should say, was the year I thought we were going to win again. I qualified fourth, which was the same place where I qualified in 86. But we led again a lot of the race. And with about 15 laps to go, 12 laps to go, my front wing broke. So I lost a lot of the downforce in the front of the car, and we lost speed as a result. And in the end, a Dutch driver, Arie Luyendijk, who I had known for a number of years, raced against him even in the late 70s. Anyway, he passed me. He was driving for a good friend of mine who I had driven for, a guy named Doug Shearson out of Adrian, Michigan, and who unfortunately passed away about 15, 20 years ago. But in any event, Ari won for Doug. So I was disappointed, obviously, to end up second, which maybe a lot of people would be happy with. But, you know, when you've won and you've tasted that milk, you know, you want to taste it again. And,
why the milk? Why? It feels like the last thing you want to drink or hold after, you know, being in a claustrophobic hot car in the middle of Indianapolis for hours.
I agree with you. It doesn't sound right somehow, but I got to tell you, it tastes pretty good. And mainly because there's a lot of meaning to it. It means that you just won the Indy 500. So you is it your drink of choice immediately getting out of a hot race car? Yeah, maybe not. But hey, you just won the Indy 500. So
it's tough. Maybe that's the test we need to see. We need to see like the NBA finals and Steph Curry walks off the court with just a big tub of cottage cheese. And you're like, can he do it? Let's see. Top elite athlete. Can their stomach hold up after competing at this level?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Bobby, you said your life changes when you win the Indy 500. How did your life change? What happened?
Well, as a driver, you know, professionally, you win Indy and your value goes up tremendously with other teams. You know, they want to hire you because you won the 500. Obviously, sponsors, a company who can claim that they're partners with the Indy 500 champion, that's very valuable to them. And so your value financially and otherwise goes up. you know, as I tell people, I won about 28 IndyCar races in my career, won Indy 500. I won, for example, Laguna Seca in Monterey, California. I won that race 4 years in a row. I'm never introduced as the four-year winner of the Laguna Seca IndyCar race. I'm always introduced first and foremost as a 1986 Indy 500 champion. And then they say, and oh, by the way, he won three championships, which is frankly harder to win than just on a single given day. But that's the import of the Indy 500. And you see it when you go there. It truly does stand above the rest in terms of the grandeur and the circumstance, the pomp and circumstance, and the history, the traditions that happen at Indy that are there. You know, it's just different. And so that's why that value goes up.
What I'm curious, you've won the Indy 500, but you also won it as an owner as well.
Correct.
And you also occupied the position of an owner driver.
Right.
I think what kind of autonomy do you have just as a driver, and what kind of responsibilities add on to it when you become an owner in addition?
Well, I think, you know, people ask, what's the difference? You know, I mean, we've won twice now as an owner or co-owner, I should say, and then once as a driver. You know, people want to know what's the difference. And I think the difference, as an owner, you truly have a greater appreciation for what it takes to win that race. You know, when you're a driver, drivers are selfish, and they have to be. You know, that's part of the deal. They have big egos, and that's what drives them on. That's what makes them make the choices they make, take the risks they take. You know, they're gunfighters, you know. And as a driver, yeah, you give the team a lot of credit. But behind the scene, you know, it's, hey, I did it, right? You're an owner. You know that everybody from the truck driver to the chief mechanic to the people, you know, preparing food for the team over the course of that month. I mean, every sponsors, you name it, everybody contributes to it. So it's just a different sense of satisfaction. And to be frank, I think as an owner, because of the appreciation for what it takes, in some respects, I think it's a greater sense of accomplishment and success than it is as a driver.
Did you find it cumbersome then to be a driver and an owner, to have to wear both of those hats? Did they help each other, or were they in conflict?
Interesting question. I think I don't ever recall it being cumbersome. I had a very good team, good people around me that allowed me to really focus on the driving. We were very fortunate to have very strong sponsors, you know, during that period of time. So I really didn't have to worry too much about that. Now, I worked hard to get, you know, to bring them to that point. But for the most part, the day to day was being run by some really good people we had. And so it was less of a, it's not like when I got in the race car, I'm going, oh, you know, I can't crash it because if I do, it's going to cost me money. You know,
you could go in there. That's how I would get into the car. That's how I get into cars now.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that seems natural that you would think that way, right? But in the end, when you put that helmet on, you get in that race car and you're a racing car driver, the only thing you're thinking about is, you know, what am I going to have to do to win this race?
Bobby, you know, you can't talk about this without talking about danger. So, you know, maybe perhaps the most famous crash, Dale Earnhardt losing his life. And you keep mentioning several times now Rick Mears. Somebody told me that Rick Mears was the next to you, the greatest oval car driver of all time. And I understand, he had an accident. He was burned very badly, as I recall. His feet were almost destroyed. Tell us about the danger. And I know it's upgraded over the years, but and you have a son who's now racing. If you knew that, mm-hmm. Jordan Graham. I've never met Graham. I'd like to meet him sometime. But tell us about the dangers that are inherent in this sport. You watch Formula One. I mean, it goes so fast. You watch the Indy 500. Cars are, I mean, it's unbelievable, the ins and the outs. What about the danger?
Well, like you said, Governor, it's a lot safer today than it was when I raced. It was a lot safer than it was in, say, the 60s or the 50s. I mean, there were periods of time when death was pretty commonplace in racing. Now it's very rare, thankfully. And even injuries in cars are relatively rare today compared to, you know, when I drove or others. You know, technology has really come a long way and has not only increased the speed of the cars, but commensurately increased the safety of them, which that some people struggle with that idea that, well, if it's faster, it must be riskier. Well, you know, yes and no. The space age materials that Indy cars and Formula One cars are made of are you know, I mean, they've made racing tremendously safe over the years. That's not to say that you still can't get hurt, because you can. But the risk is, you know, the risk of that, or the chance of that happening, is certainly less. But, you know, racing, there, I don't care how safe you make it, there's still, as I said, that element of risk. It may not be as high a percentage of before, but it's still there. And so you, you know, when you're driving, you know, it's there, but you don't, you know, frankly, you know what I said about ego earlier, you know, if you're a driver, you go, you know, you feel like, oh, well, that'll never happen to me. You know, that happens to other people. And if you look at the great drivers, very rarely do you see them having accidents. You know, they're just, they have the focus, the intelligence, the commitment, the concentration that is needed. And you know, it sounds trite, but, you know, there's the old saying, to finish first, you must first finish. And that's so simple, yet so obvious and so clear. So the people that win are generally the ones that they don't have those accidents. They don't get involved in the accidents because they know, you know, where they should be or where they shouldn't be, and what's worth taking, what chance should they take, what chance they shouldn't take. You know, in Dale Earnhardt's case, for example, that really was, you know, that was the accident in and of itself wasn't that bad, but the seat belts weren't tight. And it, when he, you know, when he hit it, you know, unfortunately, he was loose in the car, and that's how he got, that's how he had these horrible injuries, and he succumbed from them. That doesn't, you know, that's happened in other forms of racing. But again, it's all about being prepared as a driver and as a team.
When you say the best drivers, take Lewis Hamilton or take some of the great drivers in IndyCars today, when you say they know when to take chances, or what, tell us what you mean by it. What does that mean? When you cut in, do you pass somebody?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, what kind of maneuver can I make and get away with it where I don't take him out or I don't take me out? You know, there's no good making a really risky pass and then you hit the guy or he hits you and you both end up out of the race. So you have to know, you know, you really have to be able to gauge what's achievable and what isn't. And of course, this is all happening at 200 miles an hour. I mean, it's not like you say, let's time out, let's think about this. You know, this is all going on while you're in the heat of battle. And the very good drivers are the ones who can do that, who can approximate or appreciate the level of risk that's needed, and then either accept that risk or not. And so, you know, people like Mario Andretti, you know, or Johnny Rutherford on the IndyCar side, or, you know,
AJ Foyt,
Rick Mears. Yes, have they been in accidents? Yes, they have. We all have. But they, you know, more often than not, they aren't, you know, and that's what allowed them to win as many races as they did.
Now, your father was in the sport, you are in the sport, and your son, as we mentioned. It's one thing to assess the danger for yourself, another to be a father and watch that. How do you, in watching your son race, was there any sense of guilt to see him follow in your footsteps, and or fear as he was going down that path?
Yeah, well, I was not supportive of him becoming a driver, because I didn't feel like, I didn't want him to feel that he had to fill some kind of footprints. You know, my father raced, but he did it for fun. He wasn't a professional. And, you know, we were weekend warriors and went out and had fun. There was no sense of pressure that, oh, we had to win this race or what have you. So when I started racing, I never felt like I was living up to something. You know, I just felt, you know, off I went, and I enjoyed it and loved it and everything else. in Graham's case, you know, he grew up, his father is a three-time IndyCar champion, you know, won the Daytona 24 Hours, won the Sebring 12 Hours, raced in Formula One. I mean, that was a whole different, you know, that's a different scenario. And yet, if you knew Graham when he was 5 years old, you would not be surprised as to where he is today. And, you know, when he was growing up, while I may not have been necessarily supportive, he was just, he was determined. And he wouldn't, you know, he started racing go-karts and, you know, he was successful and he wasn't making mistakes, wasn't getting in accidents. And I really kind of, as people ask, I really felt that as he, you know, progressed on through the sport, you know, if he had been having a lot of accidents, I would have said, hey, time out. Let's think of golf. Let's do something else. But for him, racing and cars have been his life. And even to this point today, he's 33 years old. He just had his 250th race in Indy cars, which is a lot because he started very early. He started at 18 years old, which is very young. But you know, it's his passion. It's his love. And, do I get nervous, especially on the ovals? Yeah, I get nervous, but on the road courses and street circuits, I really enjoy watching him race because I think he's a very good driver. And
wait, what's the difference in risk there as from a novice perspective? Why just because speed?
Yeah. Speed. Yeah. And the fact that, you know, the first thing you hit at Indianapolis is a brick wall, is a stone concrete wall. You know, other racetracks, you can go off the track and, you know, not hit anything for a while, or, you know, it's grass or you spin out or whatever. You know, Indy, you're going 250 miles an hour. So the ovals, I think, I know, you know, when I drove my mother, for example, she's a pretty strong person. And she loved racing, you know, she and my father, they went off and raced. She didn't personally race, but she was very supportive of it. She wouldn't go to Michigan International Speedway and I raced there, you know, for that. She'd go to Indy, but she wouldn't go to MIS. And, the risk factor is greater. And yet he's always been a safe driver. So I probably shouldn't worry, but I am a parent and parents worry about their kids.
Bobby, what about fitness? You know, you never hear much talk. You can't get in that car and do that kind of a race without being fit. So how did you work at it? And what does it take? And what is it like with the G-force? You get a certain G-force too when you're riding. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, remember you're in a race car. Let's say at Indy, you're in a race car for 3 to 4 hours, going 200 miles an hour or more all the time for those 3 or 4 hours. You're being passed or you're passing people, so your level of mental fitness has to be super strong because you've got to be focused 100% on what you're doing. You know, there's no timeouts, no TV timeouts, even the pit stops when you come in, because you can make up positions during a pit stop and you're only in there for 5 or 6 seconds. You even have to be kind of more on the ball, you know, in the pit stop than you are once you get going again. So the physical and mental demands on a driver are, I don't think there's anything in sport that that equals it. And if you look at the athletes, look at the drivers, these guys have like 8% body fat, you know, their resting heart rates, you know, 40. I mean, it's more like a bicycle racer or a track and field where the heart rates are tremendously low. So it's a kind of an unappreciated side of the sport, but it definitely is a sport.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show. Now, you're a co-owner with another legend, David Letterman. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how did you guys meet up and what approach does Letterman bring to the team that's different than yours?
Well, I mean, I did not know, but David is from Indianapolis, born and raised, went to Ball State in Muncie, Indiana. I did not know any of this. Graham's godfather is Jack Hanna of the Columbus Zoo. And Jack.
That's a great godfather. That's an all-time great godfather.
Jack's a wonderful man. Not having a little issues right now, unfortunately, but Wonderful guy. Anyway, he used to go on the show all the time with David. And I think David asked Jack one time, hey, I'd like to get Bobby on the show. Do you know him or whatever? And Jack, sure. So next thing you know, I get a call from David's people. And, you know, we'd like you to be on the show. So I went on the show for the first time in 1986 after I won Indy. You know, at that time, I began to understand David's passion for IndyCar racing in particular, for automobiles. And so we used to race at the Meadowlands, you know, right across the Hudson. And we raced there from, 1984 to 91, I think it was. And so whenever I go to the race, I'd invite David to the race and we'd go have dinner or something like that. And one day he said to me, well, if you're ever looking for a partner, I'd love to, consider me, please. So I said, okay, well, good to know. And in the end of 95, I called him up and I said, you know that bit about wanting to be a partner? Now's your chance. And he said, sign me up. So we've been partners since 1995. And David's been great. You know, he's not there on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, he works with our sponsors. He's been very proactive with charitable activities with and around our team. So he's been a huge plus for us.
Bobby, this Formula One has exploded. It must kind of irk you a little bit that everybody wants to talk about Formula One and all the money and all that stuff. What is the fundamental difference between Formula One and the IndyCar, and what do you connect to this Formula One explosion in popularity? What do you think about it?
Well, Formula One's always been very popular outside of North America. I will tell you what I attribute a lot of it to right now is Netflix. You know, where they've had this series over the last 3 or 4 years on Formula One, which has done. I mean, now you talk to young people and they, I saw it on Netflix, I saw this, saw that. That's done a lot for sure to make Formula One more popular in this country. You know, when Mario Andretti was, when he won the world championship in 1978, you know, it was popular then because of him and because of the fact that there was an American that was competing on a world stage. And not just competing, but succeeding on a world stage. And there were a lot of Americans that raced in Formula One in the 60s and the 70s. But in the 80s, 90s, it really became kind of a closed society in Formula One, that if you weren't either South American or European, you know, the chance of you getting in there was pretty slim. And but again, it's only been as of late. And of course, when you look at events like, you know, they had the Grand Prix, for example, U.S. Grand Prix at Indianapolis for a number of years. It didn't really do that well, frankly, in part because, you know, when you look at the race in Austin, Texas, for example, most of the people that are there are it's an international crowd. They're from Central America, Mexico, South America, Europe, because the drivers are from those countries. There's no Americans in Formula One right now. So the attraction for these people is to see their drivers, and they're very nationalistic, each of those countries. You know, the Dutch are super happy now because Verstappen is you know, he won the world championship last year. You know, when I raced, there were 4 Frenchmen in Formula One. Well, it wasn't necessarily because the Frenchmen were the best. It's because the French government supported it, French companies supported it, and that's what drove it. And so it's and they were very good, no question about it. But So you're starting to see a little bit, you know, there's more interest in this country, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's a homegrown interest as much yet, but obviously this Netflix program has done a lot to bring in a lot of young American fans into Formula One, and which is great, because I think the more popular racing is at any level, the better it is for everybody.
Now, in terms of NASCAR, you tried NASCAR once, didn't go back. What was it about NASCAR that didn't bring you back that way?
Well, I was very fortunate to drive for one of the greatest families in NASCAR history, the Wood Brothers family, wonderful people. Still enjoy seeing them. I mean, they were very, very, still are very famous. But you know, they won a lot of races in NASCAR. I had the chance to drive at Riverside, California, which was a road racing circuit for them in 1984. And you know, I mean, NASCAR racing is great racing. The capabilities of the car are not what they are in IndyCar racing. And I was kind of an IndyCar road racer. So while it was a thrill, it was a great experience to drive, it was not one that convinced me that, oh, I need to do this all the time rather than Indy. And of course, by 84, I hadn't won Indy yet. So, you know, that was my first objective, to get that done.
I've been to a number of IndyCar races, and you go there, it's like you go down into the pits, you get where the cars are. It's like you're in an operating room. Everybody's got to be careful. You don't touch anything. You dress up right to protect all the cars. You go to a NASCAR race, and you're standing there in the pits, and they say, hey, could you hand me a wrench? Come on over here. Help me just change the tires on this car. It's just so different. I'm just still wanted one more thing around Formula One. Would Graham, your son, would he consider, and how hard is it to go from, like, you know, an Indy car to a Formula One car? Yeah. And I understand the Formula One car is a lot about computers more than just explain all that to us, Bobby.
Well, the Formula One car is more sophisticated because the rules allow it, which also drives the cost so much, because the budget to run a Formula One program is 10 times what it is, 20 times what it is compared to an Indy car. You know, Indy cars maybe $10 million per season per driver. Formula One car, you're dealing $400-500 million a year. I mean, it's just totally crazy money. You know, I ran the Jaguar Formula One team for a couple of years in the early 2000s, and we had $250 million budget, and we were one of the least financed teams in Formula One. And the difference is seen on the racetrack, which is unlike IndyCar, where the sophistication is much more limited. And so it becomes more like Formula One used to be in the 70s and 80s, where it's car and driver. But yeah, Formula One's very, very sophisticated. And that sophistication draws a lot of interest for people, because it's, you know, I mean, it's like, for those guys, it's like going to the moon every race, in terms of that sophistication. You know, I think the big difference is in Formula One, the car makes a much bigger difference in the performance of the team versus, say, an IndyCar or NASCAR, for that matter. It's more, a little bit more old school IndyCar and NASCAR than in Formula One is. And you see that in the results, because different teams win and qualify on pole every weekend in IndyCar, whereas in Formula One, it's the same one or two teams that are, you know, dominating the sport every given year.
I'm curious, there's always talk, especially now, about the politicization of sports. When it comes to race car driving, sponsorship is such a big deal. And now we're kind of living in a culture where corporations and their connections to whether it's politics or causes is more transparent and a part of why people are fans of that particular brand. And the fact that brands are also connected to this sport, how have you seen that change, and where do you see that going?
Well, I think it's been, a little bit, yes, there's politics and everything, right? But I don't think that racing has been as much at the forefront of that. I think it's tried to separate itself, or that's great, that's fine, but we're here to race. You know, it's kind of a different, the approach, I think, might be a little bit different. And yet, I think racing's always been open, particularly IndyCar racing, even NASCAR racing, open to some of the concepts or theories or what have you that are, you see prevalent now. You know, for example, you know, women drivers, that's been something that's been pretty much embraced. I mean, you saw women drivers in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, drivers who are from, you know, black drivers, there's over the years. In fact, the fellow that sponsored me, Jim Truman, sponsored a fellow named Willie T. Ribbs in the 80s. It really ended up going to Indy, also to NASCAR. So there's been, I think, an openness. There's always been, you know, I brought Danica Patrick into racing on a bigger level. You know, Ford Motor Company was behind her for a period of time, and then she came to drive for us. Danica Patrick absolutely lit the crowd up at Indy in 2005 when she damn near won the race. So I think racing's always been a little bit more open. Does it beat that drum publicly and loudly? I'd say no, just because it's been a little bit different in that respect, I guess. But it's always been there.
Do you think it would benefit from that? Do you think that's something that you could see changing?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, there's already there's programs that have been announced. NASCAR's had, you know, programs, IndyCar for disadvantage, you know, for females, for drivers of color. That's been out there. It's continuing. It's probably gaining a little bit of strength, to be sure. In racing, there's a lot of entities, people, whatever, from all different walks of life that believe all different things. It's not like it's there, but it's not something that, as I said, that drum isn't being beaten all the time, you know, like you might see in some other sport. So,
although I'm waiting to see Elon Musk in the Twitter car, I can see that coming.
Yeah.
That would be, yeah, well, Bobby,
an electric car, I can tell you that.
Yes, good point. Now, Bobby, when you're driving at 200, 250, you're 45 years old, you retire. I always think about these F-16 pilots, you know, they fly and then all of a sudden 1 minute they're out. They're not flying these planes anymore. Was that a tough transition to go from the high speed intensity, the focus of racing, and then all of a sudden one day you ain't doing it anymore?
Yeah. I will tell you, Governor, I even today I occasionally miss the thrill of driving the race car, of going fast on a certain circuit or whatever. But I don't miss all the other stuff. I don't miss the risk. I don't miss the tension, the pressure. I don't miss that. It's like a very good friend of mine is Robin Yount. Again, Hall of Famer, two-time most valuable player, you know, different position. I mean, the guy's a wonderful guy. And we talk about it, and he comes to a lot of races because he's a big race fan. And he said with baseball, it was the same way. He said he missed everything between the lines, but he didn't miss anything else. And it's very true. I mean, you miss the thrill of it, you know, what you're doing. That's what brought you there in the first place, what excited you in the first place. But it's all the other stuff, the politics, the work, the this, the that, the travel, that gets old pretty quickly. And so you don't miss that. But I have to say also, I was fortunate because, I had the team. So I was still heavily involved in motorsport, just in a different way. And I'm still, you know, we've been in business now as a team for 31 years. And so even today, I'm going to virtually every race. I'm in the shop, I'm on the phone, because this is a passion. And that passion has not diminished over the years.
Governor, I'm curious, when we talk about people getting outside the game, do you have similar feelings about no longer being elected office?
Jordan, it's really pretty amazing. I feel really blessed about it. The answer is no. I mean, but I've always moved on to other things, you know, so I knew those things wouldn't last forever, and I've kind of dipped in and out of politics. Once in a while, when I see people, you know, starting to think about running for president, they start getting in the starting gate, like at the Kentucky Derby, and you kind of think about that a little bit, but then it's all the things that are involved in it. But I just, Jordan, I'll tell you a funny story. So for 9 years, I had security, and the year I was running, and then the 8 years I was governor, the day that our current governor, Mike DeWine, was sworn in his inaugural, not only did the highway patrol leave my house, but they used to have an orange cone there so they didn't park on the grass. Not only did they leave, but they took the orange cone. I drove myself down to the inaugural and drove myself away from the Capitol. I mean, that's pretty damn stark, right, when something like that happens. But I honestly, have really never looked back. And somebody says, aren't you glad, you know, during COVID, aren't you glad you're not there? I said, no, I would have liked to have been there. The challenge was great. But I sort of did that. Now I'm doing something else. And I think what Bobby's saying is he moved into something else. He didn't kind of just exit. And, you know, he's got his dealerships. He's enormously successful as a businessman. And Jordan, I don't know how long your business, your line of work can go. But my advice to anybody is don't hang everything on that. Think about other things that you can do, because it'll keep you inspired. So it's amazing that I could say that I've never looked back, but I really haven't. I consider that to be a blessing.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, Bobby, I saw a video of you donating, or you sold the car that you won Indy in to a museum. And I think there's an interesting balance between holding on to the memories that you have and also and memorabilia, the things that become memories for other people. How do you balance those two? Where are you on that spectrum?
Well, that car, that was my winning car in Indy in 86. I felt that needed to be at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum because it wasn't mine necessarily. It was my, it was racing's. It was the Indianapolis 500's property. It was, everything that it represented. If I owned it, which would be great, but if it just sat in my garage and nobody ever saw it or rarely see it, I thought that was kind of selfish, frankly. And I thought that being in the museum was the right place for it. And I think it is the right place for it. And it's there. And they just took it to England to a big automobile racing car show there several weeks ago. Very proud of that. And it's in the right place. It's in the IMS Museum. It's a great museum. And it's a great place for people, strong fans or beginning fans to go really see the history of the sport. And so for it to be there is, I think I'm very proud of that.
Well, to follow and support the many Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan racing teams, go to rayhall.com. And to find a Ray Hall auto dealership near you, go to bobbyrayhall.com. Hey, everybody. Jordan here, your favorite host of the Kasich Klepper podcast. Thank you for listening this far. If you like what you hear, click like or thumbs up or whatever icon signifies a positive reaction. We love your ratings. We love your thoughts. Reach out to us on social media. Let us know what you want us to talk about, because I'm tired of answering the governor's questions and I just prefer to answer yours. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Kasich and Klepper is a production of Treefort Media, hosted and executive produced by John Kasich and Jordan Klepper. Treefort Media's executive producers are Kelly Garner, Lisa Ammerman, and Matthew Kugler. Line producers, Oscar Guido. Associate producer, Lee Albanese. Audio direction by Tom Monahan, head of audio for Treefort, with production and editing by Maxwell Carney. Sound editing by Abigail Sullivan. Talent booking by Blythe Asher. With additional production help from Tim Schauer, Haley Mandelberg, Lindsay Whistler, Colin Motel, and Anastasia Ibrahim. This podcast is powered by Acast.